We're extremely honored to have Dr. Kenneth Cook here with us today, where he'll be talking about diagnostic tests for gastroparesis. We continue to be so grateful for Dr. Cook doing these programs for our organization every other month. Dr. Cook has a most wonderful and impressive background. He's currently professor of medicine, the section of gastroenterology and hepatology at Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center. He has a career-long interest in understanding the pathophysiological mechanisms of nausea and gastroparesis. He's a principal investigator in the NIH-sponsored gastroparesis clinical research section and has written 143 peer-reviewed publications, 43 chapters, and two books with another one on the way. He also has the love of all of our organization because his fan club just keeps on growing, as I say, every single time. This program is being presented by the Association of Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders, or AGMD. We're a nonprofit organization, and we serve as an educational resource for digestive motility disorders. We also function as an important information clearinghouse for members of the medical, scientific, and nutritional communities. And in addition, we provide a form of support for patients and their families impacted by GI motility disorders. My name is Mary Angela De Grazia Dottucci. I'm a longtime digestive motility patient, and I am always humbled being able to volunteer to serve AGMD. Assisting with the program is Melissa Adams Van Houten. Melissa, can you introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Melissa Adams Van Houten, and I was diagnosed with gastroparesis in February of 2014, so a little over 8 years ago. And I currently serve as the AGMD's Public Policy and Outreach Director and manage several online gastroparesis patient support and advocacy groups.
And thank you, Melissa, for assisting. Just a few notes. Please be sure you're in a very quiet environment. Otherwise, we can hear everything in the background. In addition, in the first part of the program, we will not be taking any questions from the audience. That's reserved specifically for the second part, where Melissa will be co-administrating that part of the program. Melissa is always does such a great job with the Q&A portion, so she will be directing that part. And with that, Dr. Cook, this is such an important topic. And as we had talked about yesterday, I was stunned to see not only the different types of preparation for testing gastroparesis, but also the testing itself varies from institution to institution. So we're relying on your expertise to clarify and explain the diagnostic testing. Dr. Cook?
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much, Mary Angela and Melissa, for having me on today. And hello, everybody. I hope you can hear me. And yes, so let's tackle this topic of diagnostic tests for gastroparesis. And I thought, first of all, you know, we kind of reserve this test for patients who have unexplained early satiety. That means they fill up, you fill full with a half of a sandwich. You eat and you're full and you have nausea. Nausea could be so bad that you vomit the food that you ate 2 hours later, 20 hours later. There can be vague abdominal discomfort and bloating sensations. And these symptoms are not explained by what I call standard tests. In other words, the doctor has looked for other causes, more, you might say, mainstream causes like an ulcer or esophagitis or gallbladder disease. Then there's some more motility disorders to be considered, because as I've talked before, these symptoms I just mentioned are very nonspecific. So you have to be careful when you assign those symptoms to a delay in gastric emptying. So when the doctor gets around to ordering a gastric emptying study, that's what we're going to talk about. So there should be some work done ahead of time. We in the neurogastro field, you know, don't want to miss like an obstruction due to an adhesion or a cancer or some mechanical problem causing the symptoms. So that needs to be done, and then we move on to further diagnostic tests like a gastric emptying study. So the time-honored test, because we published a paper on this, I was involved in this paper, it's going to be almost 25 years ago, and that was when it was a multi-center study to look at an egg beater's test meal. Egg beaters becomes a solid food when it's cooked, and you can really standardize the calories and the protein amount in that egg beaters, the carbohydrate. It's low fat. And because of work going before this, many, many people with the symptoms I mentioned can tolerate, but not everybody, but they can tolerate the 20 minutes it takes to chew, swallow, and finish that egg beater sandwich. There should be two pieces of bread, there should be a little jam, and about maybe 5 ounces of water to help get it down. This standard test, by the way, was vetted by the Nuclear Medicine Society about 10 years ago, and it was decided by looking at all the tests. This was the most standardized and could be done in a reproducible fashion, and was chosen because a solid food gives the stomach more of a challenge than a liquid test meal. Also over the years, liquid test meals were given, and it was eventually shown that a solid meal creates more of a challenge for the stomach, as you might imagine, because as we've talked about, a healthy stomach will take that meal and mill it. It mills it into tiny particles. The tiny particles are milled because there are enough pacemaker cells. You're in a 3-cycle-per-minute rhythm. You have gentle contractions, and the meal is emptied, and you feel full and pleasantly satisfied, and that's normal gastric emptying of a solid sandwich. So on the other hand, if you have a problem in your stomach, like it doesn't relax, we've talked about the physiology, it doesn't relax, you don't have a good rhythm, you've lost the pacemaker cells, your pylorus is a little bit non-distensible. Many factors can lead to a delay in emptying. And so this test is sort of a global look at how the stomach works as a muscle. Remember, you could refer to your stomach as a muscle. It really has work to do. And when you put a solid in there, it gives the stomach more work to do than, say, lemonade, more work than a liquid that has some nutrient in it. So all that being said, that has become the recommended meal. But I'll tell you, you can look back and see what your test meal was if you had the diagnosis. I still see patients who tell me, well, they had grits or they had oatmeal. And the test lasted 2 hours. We're going to talk a few more details in a moment. So that's the classic, it's been around a long time standard meal. Now, about 10 years ago, maybe 5 years ago, it was approved or cleared by the FDA. Some of you may have heard of the smart pill. The smart pill is a capsule. The capsule is the size of a horse pill. I guess that means it's big. It's a big vitamin pill-like thing, and because inside is housed a lot of technology. This capsule can measure pH and pressure and temperature. So this capsule transmits that those signals to a device the size of a beeper or something that you hold on your belt, and the test starts with a after an overnight fast a test meal, which is like a granola bar. So it's a crunchy bar. It has the same calories in it, total calories, same amount of protein and carbohydrate as an egg beaters test. It's also consumed with 5 ounces of water. And so you take a few bites of the granola-like bar, and at some point during that ingestion of the bar over 20 minutes, you swallow the capsule. The capsule, by its measure of pH, you can tell when it leaves the stomach. You can, in addition, it measures the small bowel transit and the colon transit. So it's more than just a stomach emptying test. And belt or that device is brought back to the office about a week later, because you get data for up to a week. The capsule is evacuated with a bowel movement at some point, and you can say bye-bye capsule, and the analysis is done, and the transit time in stomach, small bowel, and colon can be decided. So that's an interesting test. Not every Medicare pays for it, not every insurance pays for it, but especially if there's interest in small bowel transit and colon, you get all three of those test results. Finally, for years, there was a breath test under investigation. I tried to find the original company is not doing that test that had it. I know we don't offer it at Wake Forest, but it was like a muffin that had a C13 molecule embedded, cooked into the muffin. And that was a test used considerably in Europe, but it never really caught on in the States, partly because the measure of gastric emptying was so indirect. That is, breath samples would be obtained for 4 hours. And those breath samples were analyzed. You had to send in breath samples to the company, but they'd analyze that C13. And that C13 came out in the breath because your stomach emptied it, your small bowel absorbed it, your liver cleaved off the C13, and your lungs exhaled it. So there are a lot of steps that had to need a very good physiology of the small bowel, liver, and lungs to get a reliable test. So I just mentioned that because you might have heard of the breath test, but those would be the solid foods that have been developed with testing to try to determine the rate of gastric emptying. I mentioned liquid emptying. Yes, it can be done. It's usually done with Ensure, and an isotope is mixed into the Ensure, and it's ingested, and then it can be followed just like the gastric emptying of solids in nuclear medicine. There's a camera placed over the stomach, and pictures are made over 1 hour. It is a shorter test than the solid, because in 1 hour, the 8 ounces of Ensure should basically be totally emptied. So it'd be nice if liquids were a little more provocative, if liquids offered more of a challenge for the stomach, but because they tend not to, it's not used as much. Okay, so that's the liquid test. We use it occasionally if somebody just cannot tolerate the volume of the granola bar or the egg beaters. might use it sometimes if somebody has an egg allergy. But any case, that's the liquid test. So those are the tests of actual emptying. Let me just mention a few things people generally should do. You may or may not get reasonable, you know, pretest instructions, and you should. But for instance, you can imagine if you're on narcotics, well, narcotics decrease gastric emptying. So we have to ask the patient to get off the narcotics or stop them, and many people can't. And that's a real problem in measuring the real gastric emptying as opposed to gastric emptying that's delayed by narcotics. So narcotics are always a problem. If somebody needs them for their back pain, some chronic issue, we get it. We know they need them, you know, to have a decent quality of life for pain, but it may worsen the quality of life in terms of GI symptoms. So it's a big problem with narcotics. Ideally, they can be stopped. Many times they can't. So sometimes we do the test on narcotics, hoping maybe it's pretty normal emptying. And really the nausea or vomiting is from something else. But any case, that's a thought process one can go through. The other drug I like to stop are the prokinetic drugs. You know, those are the drugs that people are on to promote gastric emptying to help. So I really try to see if people can stop their metoclopramide or stop their prokinetic of, really we don't have that many prokinetics, the erythromycin perhaps. The new one, prucalopride or motegrity, is for the colon, but it can stimulate the stomach. What am I trying to do? I'm trying to see what the stomach's function is, you might say, in its quote unquote natural state, you know, without a lot of drugs on board. So anticholinergics can slow it down. Often antidepressants have some anticholinergic action. So it can be tricky to, many patients can't really get off all these drugs to have a gastric emptying study. So some people feel even the very commonly used proton pump inhibitors, you know, the omeprazoles, will slow emptying. And while that's been shown, in my opinion, it's a trivial amount of slowness. And I have had patients who say, well, who have gotten so sick with their reflux as they tried to stop their PPI, they couldn't even have their gastric emptying study. So I'd rather have the gastric emptying study and have the patient stay on their PPI to keep their GERD under control, if that's really going to, you know, blow things up if they stop it for a week. We usually say 5 to 7 days before the test. These drugs need that much time to wash out. So, I mean, that's probably the biggest prep thing. Otherwise, it's, you know, fasting after midnight. Tests, these are long tests, and so they're usually, you know, scheduled once in the morning, once in the afternoon for these nuclear medicine departments. So the next thing is, you know, just to let you know what should happen in the nuclear medicine department when the test is done properly. So folks would come in from the waiting room, the meal is prepared. This delicious egg beater sandwich is brought in on a tray. Preferably there's a rose or there's a flower in a vase on the tray. Everything's looking pretty good. And then usually the patient's given like 20 minutes to consume that meal. Ideally, you're not rushed or pressured, and that's enough time to complete the meal. We like patients to eat 100% of what is presented, and at least at our nuclear medicine, they'll put in the record, you know, 80% of the meal consumed, 50% consumed. And this gives me a little bit of a hint as to how much of a challenge the stomach really took on for the test that day. So patients do the best they can. Some people can't finish it. Some people vomit it within, you know, really you hardly get one measure and it's coming back up. So it's not the greatest test for everybody, but most folks you know, it's important to us. So most people work hard to keep the meal down. So after that 20 minutes, what nuclear medicine wants to do is get a good scan of the stomach at time zero after the meal is in, and then 60 minutes, 120, 180, 240. So you get a 1 minute scan, a 1 minute snapshot of the stomach at those 1 hour time points. Remember, this nuclear medicine gives off a low amount of radiation. It's detected by a camera, a big sensitive camera that's positioned over the either front or the side or both of your upper abdomen. The camera's in that position to catch those radioisotope waves, and they become counts. And then that's done at the time points I mentioned. So over time, of course, there should be fewer and fewer counts in the area of the stomach. So afterwards, a technician or an aide will outline the stomach with a magic pen, if you will, and a computer will make those counts. And so counts in the stomach over time ends up being, you can determine really the percentage of the meal that is retained at 1 hour, 2 hour, 3 hour, 4 hour. And remember the classic egg beaters test, the amount that is retained at 4 hours, zero to 9%. So the stomach took 4 hours to really get to that 0 to 9% retention. In other words, 91 to 100% of the meal was emptied. And those curves represent the normal that we compare patients to. Couple things though, I've seen patients say, well, I had the egg beaters and I laid on my back on this gurney the whole 4 hours, and boy, did my back hurt after that. And I said, you mean, and they actually did they positioned the camera on your abdomen as you were laying down, and they said, yep. And I mean, these are folks who have, you know, 90% of the meal retained at 4 hours. It's almost an unbelievably bad result and doesn't fit with even how they look. And so I say, well, that actually, it was the right meal, but the technique was wrong. And so there are a number of issues that can go give you a false positive kind of finding. And I don't know, you might think about that if you had your own test and how close to that sort of standard did you have for your own test? So, you know, and I guess the other thing, there are some research tests using certain kind of CT scans. They're usually liquid meals, and they look at a lot of the stomach's configuration as it empties, not just the amount of emptying per time. They look at some other factors, and even nuclear medicine, there's some fancy research algorithms where you can try to even see contraction waves during the mixing and emptying of the test meals. And so, you know, this continues to be an area that's a starting point. As we talked about before, the rate of emptying is a very gross look at stomach function. And two things further. Well, number one, you go in and have the test, and maybe you do have, you know, 20% retained at 4 hours. Maybe you have 15% retained. This will be called gastroparesis. But others have 50, 60% retained, and they also get the label of gastroparesis. So, you know, there is mild, moderate, and severe, but the rate of emptying has never correlated well with symptoms. And that's the dirty little secret about a gastric emptying rate. And it's why there's a lot of interest in other physiologies that can cause nausea and early satiety and eventually have you vomit. So there's some problems with gastric emptying, but the delay can be diagnosed. I have maybe 10%, maybe even a little bit more of my patients with these symptoms, they actually have rapid emptying. I'm actually surprised by the test result. The test was done very well, but in 1 hour, 70% of the meal is emptied, only 30% is retained, and we have parameters to make the diagnosis of rapid emptying. So that can cause similar symptoms, and it's picked up on this test. And then there are many patients we've talked about before who have these symptoms, and in my clinic, maybe 30% will have delayed emptying, and the majority, even up to 70%, will have normal gastric emptying. So that part of stomach function is actually normal. So the test gives us that overall look at the stomach's work rate. It can be delayed, it can be rapid, it can be normal. So, it's a marker, it's not the whole thing. And for years, we've tried to develop drugs that will increase the rate of emptying. Thinking if we just increase the rate of emptying when it's slow, folks would feel better. And to this day, nothing has worked. And it's why over the last 10, 15 years, there's been regular questioning, what is the rate of gastric emptying really help? How is it helping us? It doesn't seem to relate to symptoms that well. And if we try to improve it, it doesn't help symptoms. And so this is the NIH study we published about 4 months ago showed that at 1 year, 40% of those people with gastroparesis no longer had gastroparesis. So indicating, just because you have the diagnosis this year doesn't mean you're going to have it next year. It's not for many people etched in concrete. I guess you could say, on the other hand, 60% of the patients with gastroparesis did have it, and they have a more, we don't know why there's a difference. So obviously many patients even listening know, well, my gastric function has been retested and every time they test it, it's delayed. Well, that's a pretty, chronic and consistent finding then. But the other thing was that the patients who had normal emptying at a year or delayed had the same severity of symptoms. Their symptoms were no different than baseline, even though they now no longer had a increased normal rate of emptying. And that brings up the whole other thing we've talked about. There are other gastric mechanisms for symptoms besides the rate of emptying, and they include the ability of the stomach to relax, to receive food, that stretch or accommodation function of the stomach can be poor. And then we talked about electrical rhythms. You can have an electrical rhythm problem with or without a stretch problem, and those more subtle stomach physiology problems can also cause symptoms. And we mentioned the pylorus, a lot of interest in the pylorus, the valve that the sphincter that regulates gastric emptying can be in spasm, can be discoordinated with contractions, and it's another subtle factor that can mess up emptying, or it's just bad enough to cause symptoms, but not bad enough to delay emptying. So these are areas that need better drugs and treatment and so on. So that's pretty much what I wanted to say about the diagnostic tests for gastroparesis. There aren't that many. They relate to solids or liquids. There needs to be as many drug stops that might interfere as possible. Talked about some test factors at the Nuclear Medicine Department and some general results. So, Mary Angela, what do you think? Do you have any questions, or do you want to start some questions at this point, or is there some areas that I might have neglected?
Oh, I think you did a perfect job, as always, covering all of the key points there. And I just want to stress, too, because so many patients say to me, well, I took the test at one place. Now I'm seeing a new doctor, and they want me to take all these tests again. And I think one of the important points is, because every institution may do it differently, or, you know, at that particular point, whether it was read correctly or not read correctly, there are many factors involved. Am I correct, Dr. Cook?
Yeah, that's thanks for bringing that up. Absolutely. So when I see there's two reasons I like to repeat a test at my place. And that is, number one, the patient tells me they had a gastric emptying study, you know, 2 years ago, or sometimes even a year ago, and it was done somewhere else. So number one, as time goes on, I tend to say something like, you know, that test you had 3 years ago, that's like ancient history. That's like you had that in the Greco-Roman times. That is so far in the past, and yet you continue to have symptoms today that are no better, that I need to know how your stomach's functioning today. And now that we know some people get better with their gastric emptying, you know, it's not like a one-time test. I don't want to repeat it if you just had it 3 months ago, but also if you go somewhere, you know, for another evaluation, I also say, well, look, I know how our people do it. I think we do it as well as it can be done by latest recommendations or by the old standard recommendations. And so I need to verify. I might want to verify that it's as slow as somebody else says it is. And so I those are a couple of reasons why I really like to encourage my patients to repeat tests. If they're getting old and stale, we need to have fresh data. Really, it's about fresh data, because I think patients should know that, you know, every day the body is trying to heal itself. You know, nothing is ever static. Body is either trying to heal itself, or it's kind of losing the battle to heal itself, but it's never standing still. So these, if the test has gotten a bit old in time, and if there's a new place, I certainly would encourage you to go with that study. But the other thing is, we never, at least at Wake, we'll never order the gastric emptying study on a hospitalized patient with nausea and vomiting. You know, to me, the gastric emptying is done best as an outpatient. You're more of the walking wounded, but you're not so bad that you're in the hospital getting IVs and IV drugs, and you know, it's the worst scenario. You try to get people you know, better, ambulating, keeping liquids down, go home and do that gastric emptying test. Maybe even a month later or more. You want to do it in a more stable time when you can, in fact, successfully eat that egg beater sandwich and keep it down. To go down to nuclear medicine as an inpatient and just throw it up because you're in the middle of a flare, we stop that, except under maybe extreme circumstances. It's not a good test to do at that time. Anyway, there's a couple other
point. Yeah, that's a very good point that I hadn't even thought of. But yeah, I think at this point, we're going to turn the program over to Melissa, and Melissa will do the Q&A. Melissa, I'm going to unmute everybody.
Okay, thank you. I guess my question before we open it up would be, if considering the studies that you've mentioned, and if the symptoms sort of don't always correlate well with the amount of food retained, do you see a point where the GES will sort of fall out of fashion or become obsolete? I mean, I know I see GIs right now talking about the overlap between functional dyspepsia and gastroparesis and how that's sort of a spectrum. So if that's the case, do you see a point where we're just going to base diagnosis and treatment on symptoms and just do away with this GES completely?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we're right in that, I think we're right in the center of that debate with a couple of interesting things happening. Because you might say, diagnostic category called functional dyspepsia, we can't seem to get rid of those two words. The word functional I don't like, and the word dyspepsia I don't like. But if you take away those two words, what we're talking about are patients who have postprandial distress. So those are funny words. You take away those words, what do the doctors mean by postprandial distress? Well, it's the person who after they have early satiety, they fill up right away, they have nausea, they may have vomiting, they may have some abdominal discomfort. In other words, these are gastroparesis-like symptoms, but these patients have normal emptying. And these are the patients, there are more of these patients than those who have the delayed emptying. But both groups have loss of the interstitial cells of Cajal. Both groups have loss of the pacemaker cells. Both groups have dysrhythmias. So the other NIH paper that came out that I was lead author on about 2 months ago, maybe three, showed that the patients with gastroparesis and normal emptying, or FD, they had the same problems with gastric accommodation. They had the same dysrhythmias. They're basically, kissing cousins. They're on the same spectrum of disease. It's just that the group, one group does not have delayed emptying. And so I think it's going to be some time before we get, everybody measuring their electrical rhythm and their gastric capacity. But those are the tests that also subtype gastroparesis. We didn't talk about, if you combine those tests, you can subtype gastroparesis, because there's a group with gastroparesis that has normal rhythm and they really respond well to pyloric therapy. We did a session on that a while back. And so I think I don't know that it'll go away. It's just they're so it's just like embedded in people's thinking, and there haven't been any other tests to speak of that have kind of helped make it yet, and to do more physiologic testing of the stomach so we know what drugs or stimulators, devices to use. And here's where I think the stomach is a lot like the heart. When the cardiologists work up heart disease, they don't just look at the cardiac output. They have what's called the cardiac output. Well, we have the gastric output, with the gastric emptying study. But if you have a delayed cardiac output, they don't stop testing. They don't say we know what to do. They'll look at the valves with ultrasound. They'll look at the EKG rhythm with they'll put you on an exercise. You see, they're smarter. They know it's not just the output. But here we come up with all kinds of drugs and other things we hope will work. It's a big hope because we're only measuring this output. So Melissa, I think down the road, you would do like a gastric emptying to see, well, are you in the category that you're all sick, same symptoms precisely, actually. But one group, let's see if you're in the group with delayed emptying. Let's see if you have the normal emptying. But then let's do the electrogastrography, the water load, and say, oh, you're delayed and have normal rhythm, or you're delayed and have a dysrhythmia. And also, how does your stomach relax or stretch? And suddenly, you've got a lot of information to coach with diet or drugs or devices. So it's a long answer to your question, but I think as we appreciate the underlying pathophysiology, we might not get rid of the test, but we can make the test more, it's just one test out of several that need to be done to assess what to do, what the stomach has going wrong, and then what to do about it.
I think that's an excellent point, and I've never heard it quite put that way, you know, the tests in conjunction with each other. I really do think that's a good point. And one of the questions submitted through the registration forms was, what are your thoughts about utilizing EGG, electrogastrogram? And I had been reading about the FDA just approving a device from Alimetry, I think is the company.
Yes.
Doing something along those lines, mapping electrical activity. So would you be of the camp that thinks that that might be good in conjunction with the GES then?
Well, funny you should bring that up, because I started doing electrogastrography in about 1985. And about, I don't know, 15 years ago, when I was at Penn State, at that point, to do electrogastrography, you needed about three PhDs to analyze the signal. And so working with a psychophysiology department at Penn State and medicine, we actually created a program that would make this test easy to use for doctors. And eventually I tried to get it, Penn State tried to spin it off into some sort of a company, and they couldn't do it, so I took it on. So believe it or not, there's been a super small company called 3CPM Company that I kind of started and founded, holy cow, 15 years ago, and it does exactly what I just said, but we've published on it. You can look it up, but I mean, the real issue was, how do you use it? How do you use this information? And we didn't have drugs or devices at that time. Very many have ever been tested looking at the electrical rhythm, but you can be so far ahead in your development of something that it's not really the right time. And now you go forward 15 years, we know that the one cell that's gone in gastroparesis and functional dyspepsia, it's the pacemaker cells. They are depleted. And as they become depleted, you develop these rhythm problems. And now fast forward, actually other researchers, other investors say, yeah, there's something here. This was a real signal. And so for the first time in 20 years, there's actually a new EGG device out there, but actually something I've been working on for years has been there and available. It's the 3CPM company. And so guess why we chose 3CPM? Because 3 cycles per minute is the best rhythm to be in. But in any case, I'm quite excited that there are others interested in this electrical rhythmicity. And it's awesome that you're aware of that. Those who are listening can, begin to say, well, when can I get my, electrogastrogram? But we have control data on a healthy population, and we can define if you're in a normal rhythm in response to this water ingestion versus these dysrhythmias. So I've used this in my practice for years. It has helped me understand the stomach, and it has led to the papers I've written on subtyping gastroparesis by electrical rhythm.
I appreciate the answer. I think a lot of us are just maybe not aware of some of the things that have gone on in the past, some of and how these tests are still being used. So I appreciate that very thoughtful answer. The callers on the call are waiting, I'm sure, very patiently to ask questions. Is there anybody on the call who would like to ask Dr. Cook a question? I think I heard someone. Can you tell me your first name? I thought I heard somebody speaking up, but it might have been background noise. Okay, I will start with a question from the registration forms then. Krista C. asks, are you seeing a worsening of GP post-COVID or new onset diagnoses with long COVID? And I guess I would add to that question, if you are, do you think that maybe some testing of stomach issues should be standard for those who have long COVID or who have had COVID with digestive issues?
Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you. You know, because so many patients who get their acute COVID have nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, the GI tract does take an immediate hit in many, many cases, even though primarily it's lung problem that will do people in. And so in my own practice, I've been expecting this surge of patients coming in who, you know, their local doctors just don't know what to do. The patients keep having symptoms. But, you know, at this point, I bet I've had, I don't know, less than seven that I can think of who have come to the office and said, you know, I was fine until I had COVID, and now I'm in my fourth month, fifth month, 6 month, 9 month of gastroparesis-like symptoms, you know, the ones we've just talked about. And so either the cases are mild, the cases are happening, and somebody's very sick for a few months, but they get better. And they get better, so there's a lingering symptom or two, but it's not so bad that they're being referred to me. And so actually we had a whole NIH set of questionnaires set up to capture these folks as they would come in. But I think the good news is, for the most part, there's going to be a few, I think, who become infected and it does something severe and more chronic to either those pacemaker cells or neurons or the muscle of the stomach, and there is a subset that's chronic. But in terms of a surge or large numbers, I really haven't seen it. We thought we would. Like I said, that being said, I'm sure there's a percentage, but it must not be huge, that is going to get into long-term symptoms. But guess what? We would see this after, oh, in any winter, the influenza or a GI kind of bug goes through a community, and a few people would show up in clinic that would say, I was fine until I had that GI virus, you know, 6 months ago. We've seen that with any number of viruses. There's a certain percentage. They couldn't fight it off. It damaged those particular cells, or even something in the autonomic nervous system, the vagus or the sympathetic nerves. It just dinged them enough that they're stuck in some chronic nausea syndrome, or with or without delayed emptying. So that's what that's what my experience has been thus far with post-COVID nausea and vomiting.
Okay. Is there anyone else on the call who would like to ask a question to Dr. Cook?
Yes, I have a question.
Yes. Can you tell me your first name?
Donna.
Hi, Ms. Donna. Go ahead.
I had a GES test done way back in like 2000, and it came at back abnormal rhythm. But I've had two GES tests done, and they both come back normal. And my main symptom is just nausea.
Yeah. So by GES, do you mean gastric emptying study?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've had like three gastric emptying studies, right?
Yeah, two that both came back normal, and then I had the rhythm test done at Hershey Med, where you were. Actually, my doctor is Dr. Lacey, who he said he studied under you.
Oh yeah,
Dr.
Absolutely.
Paul Lacey.
Well, hello. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure. Dr. Lacey is in Harrisburg, and absolutely.
Correct.
And yeah, so you surely had an electrogastrogram when I was using it there and developing it to become a commercial item.
Yeah.
So your
initial
and
that test came back abnormal, but every time I do a GES test, they come back normal.
Yeah, so you would fall into that category where you have the symptoms. You have nausea, you have chronic nausea, and you have an electrical rhythm problem, but it's not so bad that you have delayed emptying.
Correct.
So a lot of folks would say, you know, you have this term I don't like, functional dyspepsia. But I would turn that
correct,
around.
Because,
no, you have a problem of rhythmicity. You've probably lost a certain number of interstitial cells of Cajal. And, you know, we don't know how you, I don't know what the water load volume was, but you may have a problem with gastric accommodation. And actually, you know, that's good that in that you don't have the delay, you're not on that spectrum of this neuro gastrointestinal or gastric.
Yeah, I don't get the full feeling either. I just mainly get like the nausea.
Yeah. So that's where this technology, you know, needed the next step, and that is to be linked with a drug that you might take to help the rhythm, you know, to help the stomach get into a better rhythm. And
okay.
That's what the heart doctors would do. You know, your pump is okay, but you have a rhythm problem. You have atrial fib, atrial flutter, and they have a gazillion drugs. We have like Reglan. Maybe we use, a touch of erythromycin. You know, we just have to kind of try drugs that might help the rhythm, and that's a problem. You know, we don't have drugs that restore the ICCs.
Correct.
That's why we start with diet. You know, and sometimes we say, well, if you alter your diet, I mean, have you found any diet or any drug that's helped after all these years?
No. We went the whole way down to like a very bland diet, and it still doesn't. Nothing actually seems to help it. It's like I'm in this chronic stage of nausea, and not food related. And like the Reglan didn't work. You know, I've no difference on the Reglan.
So, you know, this is where the diagnosis and treatment of nausea becomes so tricky. And the next thing I do is I say, ask people, well, like, is your nausea located like in your head, your chest, above your belly button, below your belly button? I actually ask people, where do they feel it? Where do you feel your nausea?
Mainly like in my like throat or whatever. Occasionally I'll get where my stomach feels upset, but mainly, you know, just the feeling of, you know, ready to vomit.
Yeah. So, you know, this is where, you know, if you try your stomach drugs, then you start to wonder, is this nausea really coming from the stomach? Is it coming
right
from Is it coming from atypical acid reflux? Is it coming from constipation? You know, patients who are constipated with severe constipation, you know.
Yeah, I do get that occasionally. Yeah, like my intestines are slower.
Yeah. So sometimes you have to work on the colon to get the colon function better. And that actually, you know, because your colon is working better, your stomach feels better. And this gets at the differential diagnosis of nausea. There may be something non-gastric going on. But yeah.
Right. That's what I've wondered already. Yeah.
Yeah. I would have, if you still see Dr. Lacey, say hello, say, check out atypical GERD, small bowel bacterial overgrowth. Can we get my colon going better? Because we've tried everything for the stomach. And sometimes I think that stomach dysrhythmia can even be, you know, maybe it's responding to what's going on around it, small bowel, colon, esophageal problem. And I presume that your gallbladder is out.
No, as a matter of fact, it's not.
Okay, well, so anybody who has nausea or discomfort after eating, you know, if there's any kind of worsening after eating, when I see patients in my office and because 70% of my patients, somebody's already taken the gallbladder out. And if they say, oh, my gallbladder is in, I go, really? I say, well, I think we need to test your gallbladder because that can be a tricky organ as well in terms of nausea, particularly nausea that's worse after eating.
Okay. Yeah, mine can be like any day, you know, not necessarily after eating. I just, you know, will be like a few hours later, I might feel nauseous or wake up in the morning feeling nauseous. So that's why it's not really food related that I can attribute it to.
Yeah, food, and that relationship can be subtle, and waking up in the morning with nausea when the stomach's emptying can be acid. That's a clue. Mm-hmm. Usually with gallbladder, it's worse after eating, but it doesn't have to be 30 minutes after eating. It doesn't have to be textbook, but it's another factor. So as I say, your case shows the stomach's pretty strong. It empties okay. Yes, there's a subtle rhythm problem, but with a lot of nausea in your throat and not always being related to meals, it's time to look at some of these other causes of nausea. My book entitled, I should have written this book for patients, but it's for doctors, but it's called Nausea and Vomiting, Mechanisms and Management. But it really goes over, you know, nausea from the esophagus, nausea from the stomach, nausea from the gallbladder, nausea from the small bowel. That's like ad nauseam. I mean, nausea can come from any of these organs that are dysfunctional in some way.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's
makes
a
lot of sense.
Thanks for those comments. They're right in line with what we've been talking about.
Yeah.
I know we're running very short on time, but we do have someone. I cannot see your name, but you have your little hand symbol, raised hand up. Would you like to ask a quick question for Dr. Cook?
Yes, this is Renee. And I have a 21-year-old college student who got sick about a year ago, and he has gone through a ring of tests, and he's done the gastric emptying, which showed positive for delayed emptying. I think he was still at 90% full after the 2 hours, and then ended up catching up at the end of 4 hours. He's done the breath test, which was negative. He's done the capsule endoscopy, which was negative over at Wake Forest. They did a gallbladder scan and everything looked good. There was no stones, but then they actually did a functioning test of his gallbladder, which showed that it was not functioning. It was at like a 18%. So they removed the gallbladder. He's had his appendix removed and he still has nausea, fullness, diarrhea 5 times a day. He only eats 1 meal a day, and he was an athlete, and now he's down to like 150 pounds at 6'4". And we have been to the Cleveland Clinic recently and getting ready to do another colonoscopy and an endoscopy and an ultrasound. So we're kind of like at a loss for this 21-year-old of what else to do. And he did have the delayed MTM a year ago.
Yeah, so that's a very difficult case, and I think that yeah, they went through a lot of different things. So when the gastric emptying is delayed at 2 hours, but it catches up at 4 hours, we tend to call that gastroparesis, but I kind of put a little asterisk there because, like we talked about, the work of the stomach caught up, and so. And then the gallbladder was sluggish. So yeah, I would agree in taking that out because that could be it. But now it sounds like there's still weight loss and a lot of diarrhea. Sometimes you can get diarrhea after the gallbladder comes out. Did he have the diarrhea before the gallbladder came out?
Yes.
Yeah, so then, then it's almost time to start redoing things, and you start with the looking at the mucosa at the endoscopy, and maybe they'll find, something that would pull together the diarrhea syndrome, like a colitis of some sort that would account for diarrhea. Most of our patients, with gastroparesis, they don't have diarrhea, of course, unless it's dumping syndrome, and he had the opposite. And then they check for SIBO, right? The small bowel bacterial overgrowth.
I don't know if they checked for that or not.
Okay,
Um,
that's
I
possible.
I had asked the doctor at the Cleveland Clinic, and he was like, "Well, we don't see XYZ from your previous test." So, no, I don't think they checked for that.
So I think this way get a second opinion, and the doc really needs to do his own tests. And so it sounds like you're involved in that. And heck, I'm at Wake Forest, so at some point, did I see your son?
No, we saw Dr. Medoff after coming from Wilmington, North Carolina.
Okay.
We saw we are now seeing Dr. Medoff, who referred us to the Cleveland Clinic, and we're working back and forth between those two offices.
All right, well, great. Yeah, Dr. Medoff's over there in Greensboro. So, I think you're still working through the various symptoms, and hopefully we'll get a more specific diagnosis. And I think, the stomach delay at 2, but normal in 1 at 4, is not, it's good to be looking at other organs at this point.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the talking about your son's case.
We would really like to keep Dr. Cook here all day, but I suspect that he has other things to do. So we probably should wrap this up and I should turn this back over to Miss Mary Angela. I would like to say, though, that all these programs are recorded and they will be on the AGMD website for you to consult a little later on.
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you for always doing such a great job with the Q&A. And Dr. Cook, we can't thank you enough for all you do for your patients, for their families, for AGMD, and all of the pioneer territory you're in with the research. And you're not only a beacon of hope, but you always share that lantern of education, which is so important for all of us. To all of you, as always, I speak from my heart. Thank you for being here today and for being such incredible heroes. Your willingness to learn, share pieces of your life, and help others who are suffering with gastroparesis is always so humbling to me. And know that day and night, you remain in my prayers and in my heart. God bless you all. Happy summer and take care. Bye-bye.